This media has been presented to you by the Maryland Men of Faith, where men are challenged and encouraged to form the character of Christ. For more information, please visit mmof.org.
I was told to introduce myself briefly for the recording. So my name is Torben Berglund. I'm a Norwegian. I'm a psychiatrist. Worked clinically for many years, or not that many years, but for a good amount of time in Norway before I started working for the church in 2015. And now I am in the health ministries department of the General Conference, and my focus area is mental health. And I think, as I said earlier, was often spoke about this topic before while I was in Europe. For some reason, there's been demand for other kinds of topics. But I really, when I heard the theme for this weekend, I thought, well, this is an opportunity to talk about this again, about attachment. And this is the first time I've been speaking to an all male audience. So I was certainly a bit curious how that would be. We had a problem in the first session, is that people asked too many questions and there was too much engagement. In other words, I didn't get through my stuff almost. So I actually got the advice at lunch. Someone said that I ought to do the presentation, go through everything, and then we can have a discussion. So if you have questions, please take a mental note of them, and I'm happy to discuss it afterwards. I have this problem that I'm actually a very shy person. And when I was in school, almost in my sort of grade books, notebooks, the teacher always would write, "Torben could speak more. Torben is very quiet." And I was all my struggle and challenge and fear always when I was doing, like initially when I would start doing Sabbath school and talks, it was always that I would run out of something to say. Now that I've been working for the church a few years, like I'm starting to have the opposite problem, that I have too much to say. And I'm doing the same presentation and they just take longer and longer to do. So, but I hope we'll get through this. And I hope it will be relevant. It definitely seemed like it was relevant and people could connect with it in this morning presentation. So let's just have a word of prayer and then we'll get into it. Dear Lord, we thank you that we can be together here today, talk about things that are important in order to how can we be good men, how can we be men who mirror your image in this world. And Lord, we pray that you will help us, guide us, educate us as we talk about this. We may be in different places, we may have different kind of challenges, but please may your spirit apply whatever is being shared today to our own lives and our own hearts as we need it. Lord, we pray in your name. Amen. I changed the title a bit from what was announced, and that is in acknowledging that fear is something we all live with. And fear is appropriate in this world. This world is a dangerous place. It's a threatening place at times, both to our physical, mental, and social well-being, and also our spiritual well-being. So the fear response, it's natural, it is healthy, it is appropriate. The problem is when fear is applied to things we should not be afraid of, or in situations where we should not be fearful. And that is the challenge with this topic that we're going to talk about. Attachment really is how do we form close emotional bonds to other people. And that's a positive thing. We want that. We need that. But the challenge is that we are dysfunctional. Each and every one of us is, on some level, in some area, somewhat dysfunctional. And we are relating to other people who are dysfunctional. We're not saying that people are bad. We're not saying that that they're sick. But we are all broken on some level. And that makes it a challenge in when we are trying to cultivate the good things between us. Also because our brokenness can get in the way of it. And that's very much what attachment theory is trying to sort of explain. How do we manage this? How do we manage our wounds, our impulses, our tendencies to do certain things in response and interaction with other people? And for me, this is very personally meaningful myself, and that's one of the reasons why it's a favorite topic to present on. It's a very nice to present on because it's usually a very popular topic. People listen, people connect, engage in it. But also in my own life, this has been very important also to try to understand more about in my own patterns and how I relate to other people, how I connect with other people. And professionally, as a psychiatrist, it's been super important in trying, because so much of what people struggle with are relationship issues, past or present issues that people struggle with. So that's some of the background for this. The question initially, sort of closeness, how do we deal with closeness? How do we feel about closeness? I think all of us probably sort of in like our initial response, like closeness is something good, closeness is something we want. But for some of us, it may trigger things also. It may be challenging. We have this term like someone gets too close. That's something uncomfortable about that. And for some of us, it can be like, when does it become too close? When do we actually become stressed when someone comes close? Or when do we become stressed when someone is not close enough, when there's too much distance? And this is basically where we are very much struggling, and we may be in very different places as how we relate to other people. So that's basically what we're trying to look a bit deeper into. Just some the ad. This is a picture from the Vigeland Park in Oslo in Norway. If you ever go to Norway, you should visit that park. It's an amazing place. These granite, huge granite figures that have been carved out by one carver. And it's an amazing study of human nature and what it means to be a human. So if you ever go there, make sure you take time for that in Oslo. I find it interesting, and I'm no theologian, but still, we meet this, encounter this in the very beginning of the biblical story, that the challenge of loneliness, of distance, of closeness is already mentioned. Even before sin has entered the world, God makes this statement: it's not good for man to be alone, and I will make him a helper suitable to him. I think this is a statement about the very basic, fundamental thing in our nature as human beings, not just men, but also women. We are deeply in need of connectedness with others. And I think this is what I find. This is in the Garden of Eden, before sin has entered. Creation is perfect. It's a much better world than the one most of us live in. And Adam, he's walking with God. He's having a closeness, an intimate connection with God that is sort of beyond, I think, what any one of us probably experience in like walking face and being face to face with God. But I think this statement also indicates that it's not enough to just have God. Wow. We need connection with other people. And that's where I think we sometimes go wrong in what we like communicate as Christians. Also that like if you just have God, if the connection with God is good, if it's good, then you will not have like all your other needs will be sort of secondary. You won't struggle the same way. I think it's so important to acknowledge we are not only need the connection with God, the closeness with God, we absolutely, each and every one of us, need this close, intimate connection with other people. And I think that's why God gave us marriage, which is sort of, by design, one of the best places we can have that closeness. But if we don't have it in marriage, because we need it somewhere else. We're not created to be alone. And that is what attachment theory really, it's a secular theory, it's a secular psychological theory. It's not sort of derived from Christian principles, but I find it's really in harmony with how we understand what human nature is and what we're created for. According to our biblical perspective. Another quote, and this is, this guy was not an Adventist, he was a vegan, but he's one of the hippie forefathers, in a way, living under the Hollywood sign in L.A. Idna Bez, that was his sort of artist name. He had took several names along through his life. But he wrote the lyrics and this song called Nature Boy in 1947. I don't know, have any of you heard? Do you know the song?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Maybe someone could sing it.
Yes. I found this interesting, this song. It's been quite popular, been recorded by many since. And it ends with this phrase, and this statement that the greatest thing you'll ever learn is just to love and be loved in return. I don't know sort of if there was any Christian inspiration in this, but I find this very much in harmony with Christian, our perspective of who we are as people. We need to learn how to love others. But what I think this adds in a way, and which we sometimes don't recognize sufficiently, is the second part of it, that learning how to be loved. How do we receive love? How do we accept love? How do we do that? Actually, and that's also where attachment theory comes and explains something about why that can be a challenge for us. And why we can struggle with that. So that is also very, very important. I will show you a short clip from a movie. It's a movie that came out, I think, in 2012 called The Perks of Being a Wallflower. I don't know if any of you have seen it. No? When you see the movie, it's a story about these high school kids. It's a high school love story with all the complications that can be. And on one level, it may look sort of like this is just a teenager film. It's not really interesting, but it has so many layers and deep messages actually in the movie. And this is one of the quotes from the movie. It's about Charlie and Sam. Charlie is the boy, Sam is the girl. Charlie, he's the shy introvert, struggle with depression, suicidal thoughts. Also, it's sort of revealed in the story he had also been abused when he was a child. That's sort of the background story. Sam, she's the girl, she's the outgoing, beautiful, charming girl. But she has the tendency, she always gets into relationships with the bad guys, the guys who don't treat her well. And Charlie here, he's this super nice guy. And they form a relationship, like a friendship. It becomes more romantic. But she gets into this relationship with the guys who are not treating her well. And Charlie here, he comes to his teacher, his English teacher, with whom he has also formed a friendship, and he asks a question. I think it's just so well what is stated. There's so much summarized in this clip. So now we'll see if everything works with the sound. I haven't had time to check it beforehand, so I'll play it twice if it doesn't work.
Mr. Anderson, can I ask you something? Yeah. Why do nice people choose the wrong people to date?
Are we talking about anyone specific?
We accept the love we think we deserve. Can we make them know that they deserve more? We can try.
I will play it one more time, I believe in repetition. And now, don't think of this just like a love story between two high school kids, but think in general how this applies to relationships, and not just romantic relationships.
Mr. Anderson, can I ask you something?
Yeah.
Why do nice people choose the wrong people to date?
Are we talking about anyone specific?
We accept the love we think we deserve. Can we make them know that they deserve more? We can try.
There's several parts of this. We could break it down. The first obvious question, of course, is why do people get into relationships that are not healthy, that are not good? Very interesting question from a psychological perspective, and I assume we've all seen that happen. We may have been there ourselves, also in romantic relationships, in other kinds of contexts, relationships where people connect with the wrong people. It's obvious this is not helpful or healthy, and there will not be good outcomes really of this. But then I think what I really like is the teacher's answer. We accept the love we think we deserve. Mm-hmm. And that is, from a psychological perspective, it makes so much sense. It doesn't make much sense, if we really want the best for ourselves and the best for others. We should accept all the love we can get. That's the way it should be in the ideal world. Accept whatever love you can get, receive it. And even in a spiritual sense, also in our relationship with God, how do we deal with this? Do we accept all the love that God has to give us? Or do we just accept and receive what we think we deserve? Then, can we help people to understand that they deserve more? And again, it's a very wise and sound teacher who says we can try. It's not an easy thing to change these things, but we need to keep trying. And it's this repeated trying, this repeated attempts at new experiences, at receiving love, at giving love, that's really what can change and can heal people when we struggle with these things. attachment theory, the father of attachment theory is John Bowlby. He was a British psychoanalyst, psychiatrist, and he was the one who sort of came up with the rough strokes of the theory, and it's then been built on by many others, and others have added to it since. And it's really become like a cornerstone theory in psychology. Whatever school of psychology you belong to, it's still, attachment theory is still recognized and appreciated as really valuable in explaining the dynamics of relationships. And that's what it tries, really, to explain how do we form these close relationships with others. Bowlby, he wrote that attachment theory regards the propensity to make intimate emotional bonds to particular individuals as a basic component of human nature. And like, would you agree with that? Is that sort of in harmony with a Christian perspective of human nature? That we are created to connect with others, to have intimate, close relationships with others. And then he says, this is already present in the germinal form, in the neonate, like the newborn. And then it's important, he says, and it continues throughout adult life into old age. And that's important to recognize, that this need for other people, this need for close relationships and connection and bonds with other people, that's not something we ever outgrow. We know that very well from children, how totally dependent they are on caregivers. Yeah. But that dependency, we never outgrow that need for connectedness. Yeah. But when you see like a child who doesn't get it, you see it's very obvious that they won't thrive. They may even get sickly. Their risk of dying is significantly higher when they don't have good bonds with a caregiver. And we know that the horror stories of these, where kids go when they have no parents, orphanages, like the death rates at those orphanages were so high. Even the best orphanages you can imagine, they can't compare to the family, a healthy family context. So this is something that we knew, and this is very much like the age of Bowlby, where he comes from studying these children. But the thing is, we never outgrow this need for this close connection with others. We can maybe, if we don't have it, we probably manage it better, like at least on the surface. It's not as visible. We can go on as adults living quite disconnected from others. But it is a huge stress. I just yesterday watched a TED talk on loneliness, and the lady who presented, who herself had struggled significantly with loneliness, she listed up like how big a risk factor also for our physical health loneliness is. It surpasses obesity, smoking, basically whatever you name things that we know are risk factors against being physically healthy. Loneliness is even more damaging on a physical level, just physical level. Not even talking our mental level, but just our physical level. And that is what we also know from studying children, is that these children who are not well connected, don't have good bonds with their parents, they may not show any signs of distress. But when you measure their stress hormones, they're sky high. Even though the child can be completely calm and not cause any problems. But if they are not well connected to their parents, their internal stress levels are high. And that's what continues throughout life. Also, if we are lonely and not well connected with other people, our stress will be high, and that's detrimental to our physical health and well-being, as well as to our mental health and well-being. So basically, that's why this is so important. And this we have it's not just a psychological, but it's basically, it's what we are wired into seeking these relationships with other people who are close. Then what is interesting in attachment theory, it focuses quite a lot on these early attachments, like our caregivers, like the first people we encounter who take care of us, and say that the quality of those early attachments, those early relationships, influence the child's emotional and social development. We could also add physical development, as well as future relationships and our mental health in the future. So sometimes we who come from the field of psychology, psychiatry, we are sort of criticized that we sort of blame everything on childhood. That's not the intention, to blame on anyone anything, but we know those early experiences leave such a strong imprint in us that they will follow us. They will shape us like into patterns, how we relate and deal with the world. It will significantly impact that. And that's what we are trying to understand. How did it impact? So you can make modifications. You can do things later on in life to try to heal maybe some of those wounds and scars you got, or the needs that weren't satisfied or met when you were growing up. That's basically what we're trying to do. Further, this attachment theory, it says that like adult attachment behavior, how we as adults relate to others, it is a reflection of the expectations and beliefs people have formed about themselves and about others. Like how we relate to the world is very much based on expectations. We're always predicting what's happening, and we see the world very much through our past experiences. We don't approach, when I came here this morning, like most of you are, I've never met you before. But I have certain expectations and ways of behaving that are very much based on what worked in the past for me and what I experienced before. And that's also what applies when we enter into relationships. Even though it's a new person, total stranger, you approach the new person based very much on what is your past experience. What is it reasonable to expect of this person? What is it reasonable to expect will happen? And based on that, we like interpret the current reality, we predict what might happen, and then we adjust our behavior accordingly to achieve the objectives that we have, to satisfy the needs that we have. And this, like, don't be scared by this form. It's actually very, very simple. But it's important in order to explain what comes next. What we say, like, that we have, all of us, we have an image of ourselves, we have an image of others, and with others we can also include God here. We all have a God image. When I worked in Norway, I worked at a hospital, we included actually the spiritual dimension of life into the treatment with the patient, and we talked about their God image and had them sort of work on their God image. What we often saw that how they, the image they had of God, not just the, like the theoretical image, not just the theology about who God is, but like their emotional image, how they felt about God, often is very much connected to how relate to other people. If you have bad relational experiences with other people, you're quite likely also to struggle somewhat in your image of God and how you see God and what you think you can get from God, what you can expect from God. But first here, the self-image. We sort of distinguish, and this is like an oversimplification of reality, but that's why it's a model, where it, like, models are not the truth about everything, but it's like we're trying to break down things so we can understand things better. So, and we can be on a spectrum from a very positive image of ourselves to a negative image of ourselves. Likewise, can have a positive image of others or a negative image of God. And you can be anywhere on the spectrum there. But if you have a positive image of yourself, some of your fundamental relational beliefs, and this is not exhaustive, just sort of examples. Fundamental relational belief, if you have a positive image of yourself, is that you believe in your own self-worth and lovability. That's sort of when you enter into the world, you think that other people see you positively. That's a positive image of yourself. The assumption would be I'm worth being loved, and that translates then to what you call a low-level relational anxiety. Like you don't worry about that much about what other people will think of you. If you have a positive self-image, you don't worry so much about what other will think about you, because your assumption is that they will probably think positively about you as well. The challenge is when you have a negative image of yourself, then you distrust your self-worth and your lovability. You don't sort of don't think that the natural response of others to you is to love you and care for you. You may think I have to deserve the love of others. I have to sort of to be something better than I actually am in order for others to love me. I have to make myself lovable. And maybe it makes sense then to say that translates into a high-level relational anxiety. Sort of if you have a negative self-image, then as you go into the world, you will actually have quite some anxiety about how are other people going to respond to me. So that's one dimension, you know, the self-image part. Then the image of others, which is as important here when we talk about how we relate to others, because we have certain expectations about what are we going to encounter when we meet others. So if you have a positive image of your others, and like include God here, positive image of God, then you believe in others' ability and capacity to give the love that you need. So if you see others positively, think that they will respond positively to me. They are able and willing, they're generous when I meet them. And you think other people are willing and able to love me, and they are available when I need them. This translates, like what you say, to a low-level avoidance of other people, because it's comfortable. You're comfortable like engaging with other people because you think they will respond positively to you. But and if you have a negative image of others, then you distrust others' ability and capacity to give love that you need. And then the challenge can be your assumptions. I cannot trust others, but I have to take care of myself and manage on my own. Do you know anyone who lived life that way? I need to take care of myself and manage on my own. I can't trust others. It's not uncommon way to live. Or another way is the ones who should love me hurt me and reject me. That's also a reality. And we're not talking, again, it's very important to say, we're not talking about pathology, we're not talking about sickness and anything, because these are realities in certain relationships with certain people. Because we all know some people hurt other people. Some people get rejected and are not loving and supportive, and this then translates into what we call high level avoidance. So does this make sense? So now we're transitioning like to the fun part, because now we're getting into what attachment theory is. But you have to understand these images. So we here have like the horizontal axis, it's the negative image of self, positive image of self, low level anxiety. And then we have the vertical axis, positive image of others, negative image of others, low level of avoidance, high level of avoidance. And as you can see now, we get here four different options, four possible combinations. Again, a very simplification of life. And here you have like this spectrum. So you can imagine people would be somewhere. You can be there, you can be there, you can be there. So that's when things like get complicated. But we have four different, than what we call attachment styles. And these are strategies that we have learned through our relational experiences. We see kids as early as 2 years old, they have already formed generally quite consistent strategies for how they relate to their caregivers. That's why this is formed very early on. And the challenge is, like what's formed there early on, we tend to take it with us throughout our life. And that can be a challenge when you change context, when you deal with challenges that are very different from the ones that you were born into. But the one, what we call the secure type, these are people who are generally, they're comfortable both with intimacy and independence. What we mean by that independence, it's not like that you're disconnected, but you can move in and out of closeness. You're fine coming home, being with your family. You enjoy the closeness and comfort of the home, but you're also fine going to work. You're not suffering when you have to be away from the loved one, sort of not excessively. You may miss them, but there is certain, like you are able, you're comfortable to go in and out of this situation with this closeness. So we estimate that about 55 to 65% of the population, general population, we're talking all of us, are in this predominantly secure group where that's how we generally feel about relationships. But then there are three options remaining. Those are what we call the insecure types. And then you understand that at somewhere around 40% of us are predominantly insecure in their attachment styles. The most challenging one is what we call the fearful type. And then this is, again, this becomes like how you experience most relationships. And the closer the relationship in a way, the more this often is triggered. Fearful type is often people who have been traumatized one way or another, who had a very difficult, often very difficult childhood. Somewhere 5 to 15%. They fear closeness and they are relationally avoidant. I will get a bit more into each type so you understand better what these types are. Then we have the anxious type. They are like more positive image of others, but negative self-image. They are preoccupied with closeness and rejection. These are the ones who struggle as soon as they are away from a loved one, or the one that they want closeness to, whether that is like a romantic relationship, if it's a child with a parent, or whatever. It's like they need to be connected all the time. If there's some distance, they are very stressed of that, and about something like 10 to 15% are in that group. Then the second largest group of all four is the avoidant type. And they are the ones who predominantly think that they see themselves as self-sufficient and deny the need for closeness. And it's important, like it's a key word, they deny the need for closeness, because all of us need closeness. But some people, they live as if it's not something they really need, it's not a priority. And they try to live like this independent, self-sufficient life. We can see this in children. These are the children who, and again, I am not that you're going to go out and analyze your grandchildren or children or. So, but sometimes we see in the studies, if you find this interesting, go to YouTube and look up this strange situation and attachment. They have then done studies, they did this like studies they do where they have a child with a parent and then a stranger, they are just in a room with cameras, so we see it. Then a stranger comes into the room and then the parent leaves. And then you study what is the reaction behavior of the child in that situation. What happens in the different, like, the secure child gets upset when the parents leave. The anxious child gets upset. The fearful is very unpredictable how they will react. The avoidant child is perfectly calm. No reaction. So this may look like a child that is, oh, such a nice and secure and calm child. But if you test this child, if you draw some blood and test their cortisol level, their stress hormones, it's as high as this anxious child who's just inconsolable. And then what happens then this setup, again, then like the parent is outside, then the parent comes back into the room, and then we observe what happens then. And that's where it's interesting. The secure child is happy and glad to see the parent again and seeks closeness, connects with the parents or the parent, and then sort of is able to go back to play in the room. And now, like, I'm using this example as what children, the kids do. The thing is, like, we as adults, we do the same, just in different kinds of behavior. The anxious child, when the parent comes back, is like, seeks closeness with the parent, but is still maybe angry, may even hit the parent, is frustrated. Like, it's not like the secure child that sort of is happy to see the parent and sort of this good reunion. This is complicated, ambivalent, as we may say also. The avoidant child, the parent comes back, and the child couldn't care less. And again, we might think that that child is sort of the very well-adapted child that is very functioning very well, but it's not, because it doesn't know how to connect with the parent. The fearful child can be the one that has these very conflicting impulses, because to the ones who are fearful, the parent represents someone they want to be close to, but at the same time, they know that maybe the parent is the one that harms them, abuses them. So they are pulled toward the parent, but at the same time they're scared of the parent, because being close means they can get hurt. So that is sort of rough overview. Then we'll go a bit deeper into each type. First, the secure type. How they sort of see themselves, typical self statements. It's relatively easy for me to become emotionally close to others. I do not fear the feelings of myself or others. They're fine with emotional expression, positive or negative. And that's important. There's room for both positive and negative expression of emotion. Disappointment, sadness, anger, it's okay in a secure type of relationship. I'm comfortable depending on others and having others depend on me. I don't worry about being alone. Or others not accepting me. Sort of this is not an expression that they want to be alone, but if they have to be alone for a while, that's okay. So this is sort of, these are the ones who have a sort of somewhat easier time typically in relationships. Now things get more complicated. The anxious type, how do they experience it? And what you can say, they are, their attachment system, their attachment need is sort of hyperactivated, it's switched on all the time. They're constantly monitoring the closeness and distance with whoever is the caregiver. So they can say, I long for closeness, but struggle a lot with the fear of being rejected. I want to be completely emotionally intimate with others, but often find that others are reluctant to get as close as I would like. And I'm comfortable being without close relationships, but I sometimes worry that others don't value me as much as I value them. I may become too dependent on others. I often doubt whether others like me and worry a lot and blame myself if something goes wrong in a relationship. I'm sensitive to criticism and perceive it as rejection. And this becomes often like a very challenging thing in a close relationship, because one has to talk about things that are difficult, talk about problems. But for someone who is anxious, they perceive it as, oh, this is criticism, this person is about to reject me and leave me, and then can go in a full-blown panic because of that. I In close relationships, my emotions run high, and I have difficulty controlling them. Like often a lot of emotional expression for the ones who are anxious. Then the opposite type, the avoidant type. When I said the anxious ones, they are the ones who have this hyperactivated attachment system. Avoidant types, they more like they shut it down, they close it down. This need, this drive to connect with others, it's sort of switched off. I am comfortable being without close emotional relationships and don't need them. That is a lie, but it's a lie we're telling ourselves. It is important for me to be independent and self-sufficient, sort of not in a healthy way. I prefer not to depend on others and at the same time not have others depend on me. These are the ones who feel that closeness gets very claustrophobic quickly. There are more important things in life than close relationships. I keep my emotions in check and hide them if I'm under pressure. If I'm rejected, I have no desire to reestablish or continue a relationship. You see that this is a very different relationship strategy and thinking about relationships than, for example, the anxious type. Then the fearful type, or what we also call the disorganized type. These are, again, I said, these are the ones who often been in abusive, lived in abusive contexts. Like it can be childhood, but it can also be later on. This is dynamic, things can change throughout our lifetime. But these have often, they struggle to find something that works. The avoidant, the anxious types, these are types what we call, they're sort of organized, they figured out this is the way I make relationships work this way. It sort of works, it's not the ideal way, maybe in general, but like it works in this context. Fearful types, if often like it's broken down. I do not feel loved or wanted. I'm somewhat uncomfortable getting close to others and do not trust their intentions. Just try to think, what is it like to be in a relationship? If this is how you feel, this is the kind of expectations you have about entering into relationships. I want emotionally close relationships, but find it difficult to trust others completely or to depend on them. I sometimes worry that I will be hurt if I allow myself to become close to others. I suppress my feelings and find it difficult to express affection. I have a close friend of mine who identifies as this, grew up with two parents who were both mentally sick, like not bad people, but parents who were not able to provide the safety, the security, the connection that she needed. And she sort of, through learning about this, she's been able more to manage these challenges.
It makes it be a close friend that she's of dealing with all that.
Sorry, I didn't.
I'm just thinking to myself, close friend, your close friend dealing with all these things. Sounds like she would have trouble being close.
Yeah, and that's what plays out. So this is where it's very valuable to understand something about attachment theory, both to understand ourselves, but also to understand others. Because the things we do, the way we approach, it can be often that it doesn't really have to do between like about me and you, but it has very much to do with the past history we bring into our friendship, our relationship, our marriage, or even our child-parent relationship.
Question.
Yes.
So with the fearful and the one previous, the avoidant, and with the others, and say relating to God, wouldn't that affect the relationship with God? To me, their view of God would be so distorted.
Yeah.
How does that work?
But have you ever come across people who have a distorted view of God?
Everywhere.
And why do we come across that?
Because Christians, believers sometimes will misrepresent God.
Yes. Yeah. I think what happens, and my experience from working with people with this, that one thing is to have the teachings right. And we don't always have our teachings right. There's lots of teaching within Christianity that is horrible. when it comes to our image of God and our image of ourselves. And just for me, I find it interesting when I listen to hymns or Christian music, listening to the lyrics, like lots of it is profound, it's great. And there's quite a bit that is quite horrible. Also in the way, the kind of thinking that we have. So our theology, we don't always get our theology straight. But again, what's even maybe more impactful is also the relational experience we have in life. What life has done to us impacts how we see ourselves and impacts how we see others and impacts very much how we see God. And that's why there's so much, I think, so much emphasis in the Bible and in the teaching, like on relationship. And church should be a place of healing where we have good relationships. Sometimes we don't succeed at that, either that we can be the conflicts and all these things. They play out, church becomes an arena for acting out our dysfunctions rather than it becomes an arena for healing. This is trying to, like, say, how does this, is this relevant for our spiritual life? And it's been proposed there's two models, either that we relate to God, the correspondence model, that our God image very much corresponds with our interpersonal relationships and the image we have of others and ourselves. So it's very much the same. I've seen that a lot working with patients also, and of course in life in general. Then the other one can be the compensation model, where God is the one who is sort of becomes the attachment figure that is perfect, and sort of it makes up like the alternative to all the bad stuff that we otherwise have experienced. It can also be the what is a challenge is when people have, in theory, a compensation model. They know, like I had one patient of that, and I sometimes use her as an example. She came from a more charismatic Christian context, and she had all her theology was wonderful about God, but on an emotional level, her God image was of the critical, judgmental God. She would not, if you would ask her to describe it, what it was, it's like she would quote all the right Bible texts and everything, but on the emotional level, how she felt about God was very much a negative image of God. So this is also relevant, important. We're almost at the end and we're almost out of time. How can this change? Can these attachment patterns change? The bad news is they're not very likely to change. The good news is they don't have to change. The important thing is that we understand our patterns. Because if you understand how you work, if you understand how others work, like me with my friend, who's a really close friend, but who has struggled a lot. And I have my own struggles also, that also play out in that relationship. So but we both understand, we manage to maintain a closeness anyway, despite the challenges that we have. So it doesn't need to change. Most of us, we will keep the pattern. It's so deeply ingrained in us that it will stick. We will keep it throughout our lifetime. But this is dynamic. Good relational experiences is what is healing. And in this also, that's where God comes in also. If we have a positive image of God, if we have a positive relationship with God, that can also be tremendously healing for our attachment struggles that we may have. So that is important, and that's where we as Christians, we have something more to help us in our healing process than some who just thinks this is a cold and harsh universe that doesn't care about me at all, which is sort of the non-theistic perspective reality about the universe. As Christians, we believe that there is a God who is loving out there. And that's something that can really help us and give us comfort as we go through life. Ending with this, the dilemma that we all face in life is that we want to maximize closeness. This is like my summary of attachment theory. We want to maximize closeness and minimize vulnerability. Because just face it, we don't like being vulnerable. That's against our nature in a world that can be quite hostile and dangerous. It doesn't make sense. Like, it makes sense to minimize vulnerability in this world. But the challenge we have, if we want closeness, we have to be vulnerable with the right people. And we have to be, if you want closeness with God, you have to be vulnerable with God. Also, if you're going to achieve that closeness. So that's sort of the summary of it. I'll show, this is a book that is produced by the Trans-European and Inter-European Division. I don't think it's published yet, but it's a project they started on before the pandemic, and it sort of was dealing with all the uncertainties of life, and then the pandemic hit. Wow. And this is like super relevant. And they have this website where they produced various series, like short documentaries, films, various things that I think is very relevant and very pertinent to what many of us feel. And this book that is coming out, there's multiple authors that have written various uncertainties on all kinds of aspects of life. I've written a chapter on attachment in that book. And I look forward to, I don't have any information on when it will be published, unfortunately, but I think Pacific Press is going to be at least one of the publishers of the book. Some recommended reading if you want more information on this. Like, Wikipedia is often very good. Like, I will give some a shout out to Wikipedia on psychological topics. Wikipedia is often very good. I have very good articles on it. And on attachment, they have good articles on that. On attachment theory, these are a couple of books that are more secular books. This one, How We Love, Discover Your Lifestyle and Enhance Your Marriage. Also, if you are single, if you're dating, it's also very relevant. This is written more from a Christian perspective. So that's a good book. Like, all of them are good, but that if you prefer one that is more, sort of incorporates more the Christian perspectives, it's good. I like this organization called the School of Life. They have a website called the Book of Life. The one behind it, he's a secular Jew who defines himself as an atheist. And I don't agree with everything that he produces, but there's very much good information on that. Also, on YouTube, they have this channel that is very, very good. Another website called Psych Alive, also good, also not Christian as such. If you want to do your self-assessment on your attachment style patterns, this website is one where you can do a free self-assessment on it. And if you want a copy of the slides, just send me an email and I will share the slides with you.
We hope this presentation from the Maryland Men of Faith has been a blessing to you. Your feedback is welcomed. Please visit us at mmof.org.